This B Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K-12 curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable, real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. Want to bring IXL to your school? Learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE.
Okay, so here we are. We're doing these this episode and a couple others at NASTEC PPI conference in Oklahoma City. So Fred, tell us a little bit of remind our listeners what NASTEC is. And
absolutely, it's actually a real treat, Jethro, to introduce you to this community that's
been
so important to the work that I've done over the last 5 or 6 years. So we are at a conference called the Professional Practices Institute, which is run by NASTEC, which is the National Association of State Directors of Teacher Education and Certification. They are responsible for providing training to the licensing people and the education training people around the country. PPI is specifically focused on investigators and state attorneys. You'll hear from many of them over the next few episodes.
So this and whatever other ones we put this pre-recording in front of are going to set the stage for what we're talking about. We talked to some really great people. It was awesome, but we barely scratched the surface. So we only did a couple live in-person interviews, but we're going to have some more of those people on the CyberJobs podcast coming up. And so as you hear background noise and things like that through these episodes, that's because we're recording in a hallway. And that's kind of how
right,
it goes.
Right next to the buffet table.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Hope you guys enjoy it.
All right. So Catherine, would you start by telling us what you do, who you are?
Sure. My name is Catherine Slagle. And I am currently the director of the Office of Professional Practices with the State of Washington Office of Superintendent for Public Instruction.
And how long have you been in that role, and what was your background before that?
So I started with OSPI in 2010, so about 11 and a half years. Prior to that, I worked in higher education for 7.5 years. I ran an education program in a prison. And prior to that, I worked in the field of corrections as a community corrections officer, a training manager, and a risk management specialist.
Yeah. My last principal position, I was a principal of a prison school.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That was, you know, when we had the first GED graduation from there, I'd already been in corrections a little over 10 years when I came to work in higher education. And it almost made me cry because I was like, this is one of the first positive things that I've seen come out of corrections. So
yeah, that's really interesting. You and I have worked together for a fair amount of time. I had no idea that was your background.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit then about the transition from corrections to Office of Professional Practices and so forth.
Right. So after I received my master's degree, that's when I went into higher education. And I had been commuting 128 miles a day for 7.5 years.
You guys live in these big states. That's right.
And had seen a job opening with the Office of Superintendent for Public Instruction in Olympia, where I live. And my husband said, boy, that job is written for you. And I went and interviewed, and it was really interesting because most of the teaching assistants that we had in the prison were teachers who had been revoked because they'd had sexual relationships with students. And so it was right up my alley. And I asked, you know, I got hired, obviously, for the position, and I asked my new boss, am I able to look these people up that we used to work for us in the prisons? And he said, well, that's your job now.
Wow.
And, you know, my career has been about 30 years already. And it's been really dealing with the most negative of things that happen and the most negative populations. But what we do now is we protect kids. And I remember that every single day is the reason we're doing what we're doing is to protect the kids, not to ruin somebody's career, but to hold them accountable for their behavior. Hopefully they learn from their mistakes and they can move on and have successful or continue a successful career in the teaching arena.
So one of my questions is, as you're doing this work, you see a lot of negative things, obviously. How do you deal with that and not give up hope? Like, how do you not let that affect you and think there's just too many awful people in our school systems?
Or in our world, for them.
Yeah, that's what I should have said, is world. But,
you know, if I look at it from the teaching profession, in the state of Washington, we probably have over 130,000 certificated educators. Not that they're all working, but, and when I think about it, you know, we have, the most we've had is upwards of like 125 opened investigations at one time. And so it's a very small percentage of educators that we see. And so I don't give up because I realize there's, you know, it's very few. I mean, most people go into the education world because they want to help people grow and they want to mentor and they care. And then there's those that just, they go down, as we always say, that slippery slope, and they make those mistakes. And some of them can't come back from them, and others do, and they continue to be successful. And, you know, a lot of times I try to follow people, you know, the low-level ones that we give a reprimand to for a short-term suspension. We follow them to see if they get reemployed. And, you know, and I like to see it. Since I've been in that job almost 12 years, I get to see that, you know, they learned from what they did.
Mm-hmm. And
so
I'm glad that you brought up those statistics, that there are 130,000 teachers and 125 open investigations at any one time. That's actually really heartening to hear, that it's not, we see the news stories, we see the headlines, and so you think that it's bigger than it actually is. And thankfully, it's not. And that seems like a reasonable number compared to what Fred and I have talked about numerous times, that there's, you know, like less than 1%, right?
Yep.
So that's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, it's even smaller than that. I went into writing because I don't do math, but at some point I will pull up the calculator and we'll actually get a number there. But, you know, it's interesting, Catherine. I'd be curious to hear you talk a little bit about the fact that you're really dealing with the most serious cases. What is your office, or what is the state doing for the less serious offenses? You know, really helping educators to manage the social media world that they're in.
So, you know, we just this past year were able to update our code of professional conduct. A few years ago, there was some research done by a group in Texas, and they pointed out that Washington State didn't actually call out social or digital media in our code of conduct. We just we had a catch-all,
right?
And so we updated it, and now it is a specific code of conduct violation. And we were also at that time able to add a lower level of discipline than a reprimand, which we never had. So a reprimand doesn't affect somebody's teaching certificate, but it's a black mark on their record forever. And now we can do a letter of concern. So then they don't have to report it as formal discipline. And so for lower level cases around social media, because really what we look at is, you know, the frequency, the times of days that it occurred. Sometimes we don't get the messages, but when we do have them, what are they about? Is there any educational value to them? And in the state of Washington, the district is required to do their own investigation before they send a complaint to our office. Mm. And then we have to do our own independent investigation after that. And so, you know, really finding out the culture of the school is a big thing. You know, finding out the trainings that the educators have had. And then, you know, talking to others that are in the school, because we want to make sure that with the last podcast that I sat through, I heard the folks talking about the ethics. And a big thing for me is communication. Educators have to communicate with each other. Because if I'm a teacher in a classroom and I see the teacher across the hall doing some behaviors, or engaging in behavior that doesn't look right, whether it is or it isn't, there's questions there. It is my responsibility to go over and talk to them about that, because I don't want them to get caught up in that trap.
Mm-hmm.
And end up in our office.
Or in my book.
Used several from Washington State.
Sorry about that, but yeah, they were there. But let me ask you this, Catherine. So I'm really intrigued by this idea of a letter of concern, because that seems to me to offer you a lot of flexibility in terms of how you approach these things. For the folks who are listening, what kinds of behaviors might fall into that range, as opposed to a formal reprimand or even a termination?
Right. Well, unfortunately, the letter of reprimand just went into place just this past April.
The letter of concern.
Letter of concern. Excuse me. Yeah. It just went into place in April 25th, I believe, of 2021, and we haven't issued a single case with that because we've had a lot higher level cases. So, you know, it's going to be for low level cases. It could be just falsification on applications. And then it could be actual, you know, digital social media communications, depending on what it is, you know, and how long it goes on. But we don't have a matrix to say these are the cases that will be letters of concern. And, you know, they would have to fall at least in the realm of a reprimand. But we believe that the educator and the community are better off with just a letter of concern. And so that, you know, not somebody who's been through our office before that we've disciplined, we would not be doing a letter of concern.
Right.
Yeah, a frequent flyer.
A repeat offender. Right. I will be curious, you know, as someone who studies this area, I'll be really curious to see how that plays out.
Yep.
Because I don't think I'm aware of any other state that has that particular tier in terms of addressing these issues.
Well, I don't think at the state level.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's curious to me. If it's a big enough deal to rise to the level of the state, it seems like there needs to be something more done than a letter of concern. Otherwise, I would think you could handle that internally within the district.
Well, that's an interesting perspective.
So, well, yeah.
But what we look at is, I mean, the districts deal with employment. We deal with the certificate that somebody holds to do their job. And so there is a code of conduct. And when they violate it, there is a mandate that a superintendent has to send the complaint to our office. But once we look into the whole thing, because again, we have to do our own independent investigation, and we may do a totally different investigation than what the school district did. You know, if we can make the determination that the educator and the students and the community are best served by the letter of concern, that's what we'll issue. Because again, we're dealing with the certificate, not their employment.
Do you ever run into a situation, and obviously without naming names, but do you ever run into a situation where you find that the superintendents are reluctant to report to you because of the impact on the school's reputation, or there's a friendship? I know that they're mandated to, but I'm wondering about the human element that may pop up.
So I don't know that they're reluctant to. I think sometimes they don't even realize that they know that they're required to. But, you know, if I get a call from the media about something and we haven't received a complaint, often the answer is, you know, the school district's probably still completing their investigation before they send a complaint to us. But then I pick up the phone and I call the superintendent and find out what's going on. Or, you know, daily we receive calls from concerned parents. We don't take complaints from parents. We receive them from superintendents. But when I do receive a call from a parent, I turn around and I contact the superintendent so that I hear both sides of the story. And then they know that if they don't send the complaint to our office, if they believe it rises to a level of a code of conduct violation, that their certificate is also in jeopardy because it's a violation of the code of conduct to fail to report to our office.
Yeah, this is really interesting because I'm still thinking about this, the situations that I've experienced where I wouldn't send it on to the state because I wouldn't think that it would rise to that level. And I can see how someone out of fear of their own license would report something just to be on the safe side. And personally, I haven't experienced that myself. I have never felt like I was in a situation where I was trying to cover something up or anything like that. But I'm sure that that does happen, that there are efforts to make sure other people don't find out about certain things. So Kathy, what is it that teachers need to help them not make these kinds of choices anymore?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that in their teacher ed programs, there needs to be specific training around ethics and kind of the red flags. Let them know, you know, what can happen. It's difficult when you have somebody who is 22 years old, who just graduated from college, going in to teach 17 and 18 year olds in high school, because they relate to those kids.
And may have been dating them like 2 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they really need to realize that they cannot be the student's friend. That's not their role. Their role is the educator, or the role is their counselor, or the role is their school psychologist. And they can be friendly to a certain point, but not be their friend. And then they also need to know that it's not about protecting each other. It's about working together as a community in the school district. And as I'd said earlier, if you see somebody across the hall doing something that doesn't look right, talking with them, making sure that they understand what your concerns are, so that they don't go down that slippery slope and end up either in trouble at the school, coming to the state office and being disciplined for something that maybe those weren't their intentions. Their intentions were to help that student, but it didn't turn out that way. And so I think a big thing is ethics training, knowing what the triggers are, and communication with each other in the classroom, rather than thinking they need to protect each other.
You know, I think that's really well said, Catherine. The communication piece, it seems to me, is so vital across the board, because we need parents communicating with their children about what behaviors they should be demonstrating. But there's also built into that sense of communication the idea of community. And it seems to me that educators need to recognize that they're part of a school community and then a broader community in which they teach. And there's a responsibility there.
Agreed. Exactly.
Excellent.
Oh.
Well, thanks, Kathy, so much for being part of the CyberTraps podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Excellent.
All right. Thank you.
I would like to wrap up then this episode of the CyberTraps podcast. In the coming weeks, we will continue our coverage of emerging trends in a variety of areas, including digital misconduct, cyber safety, cybersecurity, privacy, education, and the challenges of high-tech parenting. Along the way, we'll talk to our growing collection of international experts who are helping us to understand the risks and the rewards of digital technology.
You can find the CyberTraps podcast in all your favorite apps. We hope that you'll share the show with your friends and reach out to us if you have a topic or guest suggestion. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, I'm at Jethro Jones and Fred is at CyberTraps. If you're still listening, you must have loved this episode. And if that's the case, please leave us a 5-star rating in your podcast player. And we thank you for being here, and we'll see you on our next live show on Monday.
Do you want to save time on prep work, increase student achievement for all of your students, reliably meet Tier 1 standards? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/B to learn how IXL's research-proven teaching and learning platform can help you achieve these goals. That's IXL.com/BE.